Welcome to the What Bitcoin Did podcast.
Hello, how are you all? Welcome to the What Bitcoin Did podcast. I'm your host, Peter McCormack, and this week I have an interview with Shapeshift CEO Eric Voorhees, and I think you all know who he is. So I was really chuffed to get this interview, actually. He's been on my radar for a while, and I've been wondering how to approach him, which will all make sense soon. And usually, with every interview I do, I usually spend about a day or two preparing, depending on who it is and what I'm researching and how much I need to consume and plan for it. But yeah, usually at least a day, sometimes a couple of days. But with this interview, I had less than a couple of hours. I got an email one morning from his PR team asking me if I wanted to meet up with him for a coffee, which meant an interview. And they offered me at lunchtime. So I quickly jumped in the shower, jumped on a train, and did all my research on the journey. So I had about an hour and everything I know about Shapeshift and him previously to put this together. But I still think it came up pretty well. I wish I'd had more time, and hopefully sometime in the future I'll sit down with him and do it again. But we still managed to get through quite a bit. We talked about state and money, something he's really important to him as a libertarian, about what the government should be in control of and what they shouldn't be in control of. And it's all really super interesting. So I hope you enjoy that. And we also talk about Shapeshift and what they're up to, talk about the state of prison, project they've been working on for a while. And we also talk about KeepKey, which is a hardware wallet which they purchased quite recently. So yes, I hope you enjoy all of that. And for those who've listened for the last couple of weeks, I've been talking about my project I'm working on called Open Paper. Still going well, still working on the dev, and I've also pretty much, well, nearly completed the first effort at a pitch deck, so I'll be sticking that up on the website because I'm doing this all transparently. But if you want to check it out, please go to openpaper.io. And I've also written a two-part article this week about how I would fix ICOs. I know not everybody loves them, but I do think there's a good opportunity with them. I like the way they can access liquidity. So yeah, if you want to read them, I've put them both up on Medium, and they're also up on my blog at www.whatbitcoindid.com. I do welcome feedback. I am learning all the time myself, but I do enjoy writing. I do enjoy trying to express my opinion and get it down on paper. So yeah, if you read it, if you've got some thoughts, feel free to shout out whether you agree or disagree. And please support the show. If you've never done it and you listen every week, please do go to iTunes and leave a review. I know some of you do it. I've received a couple of emails this week, actually, from people who said they've been on to iTunes and left a review. So I really do appreciate it, because it helps increase the reach of the show when people are searching for Bitcoin on iTunes. So yes, please do that. Hope you think it deserves 5 stars. And follow me on social media. I'm on Twitter, I'm on Medium, I'm on Steemit, I'm on LinkedIn, I think I'm on everything apart from Snapchat. So find me, I'm at What Bitcoin Did. If you want to talk to me about anything, please reach out. I pretty much reply to anyone. Go to my website, www.whatbitcoindid.com, and read my blog or sign up to my newsletter. And if you don't mind, please share the episode out. Every time somebody shares this out on Twitter, I pretty much see it and I appreciate it. I really do, because it increases the audience, which is what I want to do. Okay, let's move on to the interview with Eric. So interestingly, and this is the second time this happened, actually it happened with Roger as well, I was blocked by Eric on Twitter. So I had been thinking about how I was going to approach him, because I guess I challenged him on the SegWit2x thing, and I probably didn't do it in the friendliest way, and he blocked me. And turns out I'm one of only a handful of people he had blocked. But by the end of the interview, he did unblock me, and I did apologize, and I think we're cool with that now. So yes, I do hope you enjoy the interview. If you've got any questions, feel free to email me. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com, and I try and reply to everyone. Okay, hope you enjoy the show. Hi, Eric. Welcome to London.
Hey, thanks for having me here.
So you're on a European tour?
Yeah, we have a number of shapeshifters here throughout Europe. There's like 7 events that we're going to. I'm here for a few of them. And it's our Euro tour. So we made like a band t-shirt, which we've been distributing out, which has been fun. And yeah, right now we're in London.
So you probably don't know, but I'm blocked by you on Twitter.
You're blocked by me?
I'm blocked by you.
You must have said some really mean things.
No, actually, you know what? It wasn't. It was back when where the SegWit2x thing happened.
Yeah.
And all I said to you was, I think I was a bit surprised that you supported it. But like in hindsight now, I think I understand a bit more. I don't think we need to go into it hugely now, because it's, you know, it is in the past. But What do you think of the fallout from that now? Because we are some time on.
Yeah. I think first thing is I'm glad SegWit is activated. So like something material actually happened on Bitcoin and it moved forward. So that's a win. And I also think it's a win that the debate is over, right? So, and not because everyone agrees, but because a lot of the people who wanted bigger blocks left for cash. A lot of the people who wanted bigger blocks wanted SegWit 2x, but the bigger block failed. So they've just dealt with it and moved on, still using Bitcoin. And at this point, I think people spend maybe 5% of their time arguing about it instead of 80. And so that means there's a lot more time to build and get back to the actual work.
And what do you think of cash? What are your opinions on it?
I think on one hand, it's good that thesis that Bitcoin should do all or most of its scaling on chain, that thesis can happen now. So we can actually see whether that's useful. I don't personally hold much of it, and I don't think it will overcome Bitcoin itself. And frankly, I think it's inferior without SegWit. So I see it generally falling into more obscurity, but it could persist for a long time.
And so my audience know a bit about you. It would be good, just, I don't want to do the whole origin story, just but a bit of your background, but more focused on your political, social, economic views, because you are quite opinionated. And so just so people understand your background and where you come from in the crypto space.
Yeah, well, I'm one of the crazy people that actually thinks that cryptocurrency will overtake fiat someday and actually displace it in the market. And so I'm ideologically incentivized to see that happen. So everything I do in the ecosystem is built on my desire for crypto to succeed and take over the world. Basically, I want people using a free market money rather than a fiat money. And that's kind of what motivates me.
And what are your issues with the traditional monetary system? You talk about separation of money and state.
Yeah. I don't think the government should handle much of anything. And something like money is far too important. So, things like money, education, healthcare, I think are super important. And that's why governments shouldn't be involved in them whatsoever. I don't like the fact that people pretend there's a market-based economy, and yet money itself, which is the most important good in an economy, is centrally controlled by a government. That seems antithetical to me. So I want something to change, and crypto, Bitcoin, was the first thing I ever saw that actually made that realistic.
And how do you see the process of separating money and state? How do you foresee the future in it? Because I hear people talking about it, and it sounds great, but how does it actually happen? Does it start somewhere like Venezuela and spread?
Well, it doesn't happen by people going to the voting booth and begging politicians to change how things work. I think it happens by people building a better tool and the world just marginally gravitating toward it over time. So Bitcoin, is used for a tiny, tiny percentage of the world's transactions today. And I think that percentage will grow over the next 20 years to the point where people start realizing that it makes more sense to hold value in a form of money that doesn't get debased, that doesn't lose 3% of its value every single year over and over and over again, and which they can send anywhere instantly at a low cost. I think that will become obvious and useful to people over time, and eventually fiat money will just kind of look silly. I think, my daughter's generation and her children's generation will think it's very silly that people used to use pieces of paper with politicians' heads on them as a form of value, and that was cared about.
When I met with, John Pfeffer?
Yeah, Pfeffer? Actually, I met with him last night at dinner.
Oh, great guy. Yeah. Right. And he said to me, in 1,000 years' time, where we're all flying around in our Millennium Falcons, do you really think people are going to be digging up lumps of metal from the ground and transferring it around?
Yeah, or using paper because some group of politicians said that that's useful. It seems really silly.
So it's been quite an interesting last 12 to 18 months, and you've been involved very early in the crypto space. What do you make of what's happened over the last 12 to 18 months? Because it's certainly been a kind of movement to mainstream adoption.
Yeah, probably the most important theme or trend over the last 18 months was the ICO, right? So the ability of any project anywhere to raise very large amounts of money from all over the world with very little friction is, I think, one of the killer use cases of crypto and blockchain technology. Now, most of those projects are very stupid, and a lot of people are going to lose a lot of money on those stupid projects. But the mechanism of raising funds by any person, from any other group of people, is really powerful. I think Ethereum itself was the best example of this, where you had this, you know, somewhat awkward 18-year-old guy with a Russian background, and he had this incredible idea for a very sci-fi sounding, you know, pie in the sky concept. He would never, and I'm talking about Vitalik, of course, and he would never have been able to raise money from a VC, ever. That would never happen. And yet he was able to raise $18 million, and Ethereum got started, and it's now worth many billions of dollars and is changing the world. That, I think, shows the power of token sales at their best.
So you aren't anti-ICO then?
No, not at all. Now, the caveat is, again, most of these projects are total crap. Some of them are outright scams. Some of them are people that just don't know what they're doing. And some of them will be, you know, good attempts that just fail, because most projects in the world fail. So most of it's crap, but that's okay. I mean, most startups are crap. The ability to start and experiment is really important, and ICOs have allowed that to happen on a level never before seen.
So what project out there do you like then? You know, you talked about this total crap, but what is it out there that you like? What have you seen?
Well, I love Ethereum, for example. Salt, I think, is awesome, largely because I want to use it to be able to get fiat loans against my Bitcoin. I think that'll be a great service. I really love the prediction markets. I love some of the decentralized exchanges. And I love, let's see, there's another one called Mainframe, I think, which is like a decentralized chat app. Yeah. Really excited about that one as well. So there's a number of them.
Do you worry at all that there isn't many products actually being delivered, and that's compounded by there's not many being used on mass scale at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, that is the ultimate objective. But at the time we get to that, then it's done. I mean, once you get to mass adoption of crypto products, you've won. Like, that's the end goal. There were a lot of people, you know, in the early days of Bitcoin that said it'll never be used. You know, it'll never recover from this bubble up to $30. You know, banks will never take it seriously. No one's actually going to use it for anything. And here we are today, and the entire world is paying close attention to it. It is worth hundreds of billions of dollars. There are 10 or 20 million users of Bitcoin around the world, and people are finding actual use cases for it. It's still very niche. But it is growing, and I think that's been a really profound thing to actually see.
See, I see, I kind of split it in my mind into a few things, that the market for exchanges is working very well. There's some very great, good exchanges. There's the market for using crypto for payments, which works, you know, different levels of speed, but the world of applications seems to not be delivered at the moment, and I worry if the levels of money being raised is misaligning the incentives to actually go out and create something and deliver a product.
Yeah, that's a totally fair point. You know, to date, you can raise $20 or $50 million with just an idea or a white paper and some shiny websites. I think those days will end. Like, people will be more careful about where they invest their crypto. And so people have to get further along into proof of concepts. And, you know, there's only so many decentralized apps that don't really make sense before people stop investing in those and start looking for things that are like actually consumer focused that will actually get mainstream adoption. So we haven't seen much of that yet, but I'm happy to be patient.
Do you think everything needs to be decentralized?
No. Decentralization has a lot of trade-offs. It is far less efficient, and basically you do it in cases where something that you really need is trustlessness or the ability for non-trusted actors to work together in an honest manner, basically to build trust between parties that don't know or trust each other. And so money is a great example of why that's important. I think there are some people in crypto that want to decentralize everything. You know, they'll go to any website online and say, well, someone should build a decentralized version of that. I think that's kind of silly. But in some cases, it's really important. And so you'll see some decentralized apps that just take over the world, you know, Bitcoin and Ethereum being the first two.
Right. And that's kind of why I liked Polymath,
in that it allows traditional businesses with centralized operations to raise money from the decentralized liquidity pool of crypto, mm-hmm. yet there, I think a lot of these businesses don't really require decentralized blockchain applications because the databases are too slow and it's unrequired.
Yeah, and I think companies should realize that hybrid models can work really well. So a totally centralized company that looks very normal, has a normal bank account, has normal customers and a normal office, can at the same time raise funds with an ICO, which is a decentralized kind of process. And that can work great. I think you'll see a lot more of that. Not every project has to be some magical decentralized platform.
And I've seen you write a lot about the banks and the banking system. How do you see the... Because there's this kind of contradictory position we're in where some people are saying crypto is going to destroy the banks and other people saying for crypto to grow, we need the banks. Where do you see this relationship?
The truth is in the middle. Crypto won't destroy all banks, nor should it. But it will replace some of the things that banks do. I think it will make some banks probably fall apart or go away or get acquired because they're not growing anymore. But also, to the extent that we want crypto to take over the world, it needs to pull in more and more people. It needs to pull in companies, organizations. It needs to pull in talent and expertise. One thing that's exciting right now is that a lot of people that have been working in banking and working in finance are getting pulled away into crypto. Mm-hmm. They're more excited about it. They, a lot of them believe in the mission of what crypto is trying to do. And, the banks have always been able to just pay a higher salary and keep people from pursuing their dreams. But in crypto, people make a lot of money now. There's a lot of money flowing around. And so crypto projects are actually able to offer competitive salaries, competitive compensation, and people can follow their dreams doing it. That's a very compelling proposition, I think. So if I was a large bank, I'd be a little worried because anyone I would want to help me adapt to crypto would probably get sucked into the crypto world and I would lose them. I've seen this happen in many places.
And it's funny, if Coinbase gave me a debit or credit card, they're actually very similar to my bank account, but in some ways quite a bit better.
Yeah, I mean, Coinbase is very similar to a bank, and I don't say that to make fun of them. I think their role is very important in that they are the most important bridge between the fiat and the crypto world. So I think they're doing a great job with that. But yeah, they release a debit card and a credit card. Why wouldn't anyone in crypto just use them as their bank? Ditch the normal banks, and then you have a hybrid fiat crypto world, which is probably the next phase.
Right. So we've had quite an interesting last year with prices. Everyone does get excited by prices. And now the market's cooled quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any perspective on that? And I'll add what mine is, in that I feel like we've lost a lot of use cases for spending crypto as a currency. So whatever people's opinion of them, the dark markets have kind of started to go away because they've been closed down.
Is that true?
Yeah, I was reading about it this week. So two of the biggest ones were closed down, and a lot of the dark market drug sellers have now moved to using chat apps and operating on chat apps, which I thought was quite interesting.
Mm-hmm.
We've also had the likes of OpenBazaar and Yours.org say they've struggled with crypto payments. And with the kind of my movement for Bitcoin from being, I think it did move from being a form of money to now more of a store of value. I feel like we've potentially taken a backward step in it being used as a monetary item, and therefore we've had less transactions.
Yeah, I think, early on in Bitcoin, most or all of us thought that payments would kind of lead it, that we just need to get merchant adoption and people would start using it for payments and then it would just kind of grow from there. The payments side has just grown really slowly and in some cases has actually regressed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's okay. I mean, it's an unexpected turn, and what it might mean is simply that payments end up being the sort of tail phase, that people don't use crypto for payments until they're already using it for other things and they already have it in their wallets. And no one should be thinking that you're going to go buy Bitcoin so that you can spend your Bitcoin in a place that you could have just bought in the first place, but if you already have crypto because you received it in some kind of other transaction or for some other reason, then the appeal of using that to pay becomes bigger and bigger. So I think payments will actually come at the tail end, not so much in the beginning, which, I think most of us have been wrong about.
Right, so it needs to be more like a closed loop system. Once you're, if you're paid in crypto, you'll spend crypto.
Yeah, or just, you know, to the extent that people play video games that are tokenized and they have, you know, items from these games that are tokenized, and in the apps that these items exist, they can click a button and turn a World of Warcraft sword into a Bitcoin. That friction goes away, and it starts to become very easy to turn those things into means of payment. But using credit card or banks to get into Bitcoin is a pain in the ass, and then trying to get someone to do that so that they can make a payment is unrealistic.
Right, okay. We've also heard a lot about, and people talk a lot about, the flood of money that's going to be coming from institutional investors, yet it doesn't seem to be happening. What do you think is the holdup here? Do you think it's down to custody, or do you think...
It's also not a black and white thing. I mean, institutions, family offices, hedge funds have been starting to trickle into crypto, and that's part of why there was this whole bubble over the last year. Part of that money was them. Those who have not yet, I think, are largely worried about the custodian stuff. So a family office that gets interested in this, they're like, cool, let's buy some Bitcoin. How do we do it, right? And the easiest way for them to do that is to just leave the money at an exchange. If they're irresponsible, that's what they'll do. But if they know what they're doing, then they need to have some other service. And there's just not a lot of good stuff. You know, Coinbase is finally bringing out some products that'll cater to that group. I'm sure Circle's doing something similar. So those tools are getting built. But also those tools are largely just for like Bitcoin first. Mm-hmm. So any family office that wants a portfolio of the top 10 digital assets has no real way to do it. And if they have to leave their Bitcoin with one solution and their Zcash with another and Dash, you know, like at an exchange or whatever, then it causes a lot of risk. And it's a kind of risk that they're not used to dealing with.
Did they use a Prism for it?
Prism is still in closed beta.
Yeah.
So no, not yet. And Prism...
Is Prism a custody solution as well?
No. I mean, Prism is not built for people holding a lot of value, right, over an extended period of time. It's built for holding small to medium amounts of crypto portfolios over like a few days to a few months kind of period.
Right, okay.
So,
well, I'll come back to Prism. The other thing I wanted to ask you about is the state of legislation, because I saw you tweet about how progressive Wyoming is.
Wyoming, yeah.
And then conversely, I didn't see your panel, but were you on a panel where you were discussing the BitLicense in New York?
Yeah, with Jesse Kraken at Consensus.
So there's quite a contrast between what's happening state to state.
Yes.
And obviously you support the progressive states.
They're polar opposites.
Yeah.
Right. So New York came out, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago with the BitLicense. Mm-hmm. And the BitLicense essentially turns any crypto company into a bank. You have to follow many of the same policies and procedures. It is a 30 or 31 page application form. And when you actually fill it all out, after weeks and weeks and hundreds of thousands of dollars in legal bills trying to get it all together, the application is like 100 to 300 pages in length, with all the pieces that you have to attach and all the records and everything.
But there's a company you can go to help you with that, right?
Well, actually, no. So Ben, you're talking about Ben Lossy's company. Well, he got hired by Ripple. So he is now at Ripple full time.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, I did see that.
Yeah. I mean, what the hell is Ripple thinking? Like, there's a crypto project that didn't need any more, like, bad brand recognition. And then they go and they hire Ben Lossy. That they have gone now so far away from what crypto is supposed to be that, you know, I'm not going to lie. If we've considered delisting them from our own site. Because at some point you got to just say like enough is enough. You hire a crook like Ben Lossy. At what point is it unethical for us to keep supporting that asset? And that's actually a question that we struggle with.
What's stopping you?
It's still a popular asset. It's the popular coin, right? So just like business reasons is one. And it starts to become a slippery slope. Like how many moral judgments should we be making? And if we judge Ripple for one board member, should we be looking at every employee of every project? Like, mm-hmm. How far down that road do you go? It starts to get tricky. So we've abstained from doing that, but it's a thought.
Yeah, and I understand why. Did you listen? You must have listened to Laura Shin's episode with Ryan, so where they were discussing Ripple.
No,
I think there's enough concern over it, right?
Yeah. So the
Where's it Ripple? Where's it XRP? And
right. So the concern basically is you have Ripple, the company, which has, you know, some good people, some great tech. They're building basically faster bank payment network for banks, right? So they may make a bunch of money doing that, and maybe that'll be better than what banks have today. So that's fine. And then there is XRP, which is the token. And as far as I can tell, XRP has no use in the banking network that they're building. No connection to it. There's no reason to hold XRP. They've kind of become detached. And they were more connected. When Ripple first launched, XRP was a more important piece. And they were trying to be more of a cryptocurrency. And they've just gone down the banking route. And now there is this asset worth billions of dollars that doesn't really do anything. I mean, you can use it for payments, but there's lots of cryptos you can use for payments. So what's the long-term argument sustaining Ripple's price? I think it's going to collapse at some point, and it's going to be a huge fiasco.
Do you not think they recognize their place in the market, and they are almost non-crypto, and that actually they're probably a less scary proposition for traditional centralized institutions and banks?
For sure. That's why they're doing it. I mean, they're...
Therefore, Ben Larson kind of makes...
Ben Lasky. If you're trying to suck up to a bunch of banks, who better to get on your board than someone like Ben Lasky?
Yeah.
So
who knows everybody?
Sure. If you're going to just totally go down the path of the dark side and work with all the institutions that crypto was meant to supplant, Ben Lasky's a great pick. But you also have XRP, which is one of the biggest cryptocurrencies. And what are you doing with it? And at what point is it unethical for Ripple to perpetuate that coin or the implication that that coin is part of what they're building? So I wouldn't say that they're being fraudulent, but like it's kind of getting to an awkward position where something needs to happen. They need to explain what the plan is for XRP, and if there isn't one, then the price of it's going to collapse, and it's going to be really bad.
Isn't the argument, though, that XRP and Ripple are two separate entities?
Well, you mean legal entities?
Yeah, legal entities. And
that may be the case, but regardless of the legal structure, what the technology that they're building is a banking network. And the XRP token, as far as I can tell, is not used or needed in that banking network. So what is the point of XRP? Maybe they have a explanation for that, and maybe I just need to Google some more things. But from what I've seen,
I think you need a very tiny amount for each transaction. You have to burn a very tiny amount.
I don't think you do.
Really? Yeah. I thought they did for it.
I'm not sure. Oh. I'm not an expert on Ripple, so someone could certainly prove me wrong on things.
All right. Well, listen, let's talk a bit about Shapeshift, what's happening. So it's a product I use, actually.
Thanks for being a customer.
Well, do you know why?
You buy all your Ripple?
No, I didn't buy any. I haven't bought Ripple for a long time. Do you know what I did buy on there? EOS. I bought a lot of EOS on there. And the reason I've always liked Shapeshift is because I'm fundamentally lazy. And it's a very easy product to use. Conversely, because it's so easy to use and there's no registration and no sign up, I also forget about it. Yeah. Whereas all other products talk to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's my kind of like position with Shapeshift, but I have always liked it. So tell me, where are you at with Shapeshift? What's happening? What's the future? You know, what's the messages you're getting out to people?
Yeah, well, so Shapeshift has gotten fairly big at this point. We're about 100 people, and all throughout 2017, we were just trying to grow. We were trying to grow the technology so that it could handle 10 or 20,000 transactions a day. We were growing the team, so just like bringing in people and building out an actual organization of people. Those were our challenges over 2017. And 2018, unfortunately, has largely been trying to navigate regulatory issues. And because we've gotten big and because the industry's gotten bigger and trying to figure out how to grow something in legal gray area is tricky. So we've spent a lot of resources and time based on regulatory matters, both like, you know, SEC type stuff, as well as, you know, transaction monitoring and those kind of questions, which many governments have strong feelings about. And frankly, it's all been very, very depressing. I mean, the governments of the world really want people to spy on each other for them. I think that's really unethical, and it's kind of a
contentious
situation.
Knowing what I know about you, can't see that being the kind of thing you'll ever accept.
I mean, it's it becomes a hard question. Like, if the question is the business has to be destroyed, or we have to become more conservative. I wouldn't necessarily destroy everything, but it is a fight that I won't give up. Mm. So if we have to give in one area, we will fight more strongly in another. And that's kind of what we're looking into right now.
So I guess is one of the main regulatory issues you're coming against KYC, because you don't have KYC, right?
Correct. Yeah. And that's a big one. You know, under Swiss law, transactions that are less than 5,000 francs don't require it. And we're a Swiss company. Also, we're not handling money. Also, we're not an exchange. Also, we're not transmitting, because we're not sending it from one person to another person. So there's a lot of like nuanced arguments, but it's totally a gray area, and it's difficult, and each jurisdiction is a little bit different.
And where are you having the most complications? Is it with the U.S.?
Or it's always the U.S.
It's always the U.S.
The U.S. is the biggest pain in the ass for any crypto business, I think. And that's why a lot of companies just block the U.S. entirely.
How much can you tell me about the actual specific issues you're being challenged with and that you're facing right now?
I probably shouldn't go into details right now, but suffice to say that, you know, each regulator in the U.S., and there's, I don't know, 5 billion of them, they all claim jurisdiction on various things. Okay. And so because crypto blurs so many lines, you end up in a situation where a lot of regulations either don't apply or do apply, and you don't know which it is. And it gets into this big tangled mess. You know what, for example, we haven't added any new coins to the platform in like 6 months, and this is all due to US
security.
SEC crap. The SEC has been very unclear about which tokens are securities and which are not. They say they're being clear, but it's a bunch of bullshit. There are some tokens that are securities, there are some that are clearly not, and there's a whole bunch of stuff in the middle, and they have not declared where that line will be drawn. And if you need proof of this, you can go to most of the US law firms and try to get an opinion on whether a token is a security or not. At this point, most law firms won't even do the analysis. So the law firms don't even feel comfortable enough to do legal review, which is their job. And it's a big problem. And it won't last forever. Like, something will have to give. The SEC obviously has an interest in projecting as much jurisdiction and as much authority as they can, but they don't necessarily have all that jurisdiction under law. So they have to be careful, because if they try to extend their reach too much and they get challenged, they could end up in a huge embarrassing lawsuit where they lose, and they don't want to do that. I mean, their careers are on the line. So
I guess if you're not adding new tokens because of fear of whether it is a security, isn't you in a similar position where some of the ones you're already hosting are a security anyway?
So we don't take the position that any token is a security.
Right.
What we do is we try to read the tea leaves and all the things that the SEC has said, and we try to say, according to all these statements, which tokens are maybe a higher risk of being seen as a security by the SEC.
Right.
Some things we've already delisted because we felt like they were, not because we felt like they were securities, but because we felt like there was too high of a risk that the SEC would try to claim they were securities. And just recently, finally, we've been able to add more assets outside the U.S. So we've now bifurcated the asset list, and customers that are not in the U.S. actually can get more assets than those that are in there.
Right. Okay.
Which sucks. You know, like, the ring fencing of the American financial system is just this macro theme that I think a lot of people do not realize. They don't realize that banks around the world won't take U.S. customers because the reporting requirements and the regulatory risk is too big to them. And most Americans are just kind of getting ring-fenced into a financial system that they are not going to be able to escape. Crypto is really the only answer.
Do you not therefore see that maybe this is an opportunity for the SEC to rethink security regulations? And also, because so it's all new to me, the whole accredited investor.
Yes.
But that kind of seems arbitrarily unfair.
Oh, you mean requiring that you're rich before you can invest in startup projects?
Well, yeah, because I know some stupid rich people, and I know some very smart poor people.
It is a huge injustice that a poor person in the U.S. is not permitted to invest in the very kind of enterprises that build the most wealth. And if the SEC wants to say that they are trying to look out for those people, then how do they feel about the lottery system? Like, the government is running the lottery system in most states in the U.S., that is obviously not an investment at all. It is gambling, and you have a negative expected value. And poor people spend millions and millions of dollars a year gambling and losing all that money. The SEC doesn't seem to mind that. And yet they will prevent those people from investing in startup projects because they might lose their money in those projects. Meanwhile, if you're rich, you can invest in these projects. It's really unjust.
Am I right in thinking this originally came from the Great Depression in like 1929? So many people lost their money. It's actually, there's a fear that the government will have to bail out the whole country if too many people lose money in a crash.
So the Howey test, which is generally what is the test that you use to figure out if something is a security or not, came from the 30s.
Right, yeah.
And the argument the SEC always uses is that they don't want people to get ripped off. The reason that's bullshit is because if you commit fraud, that's illegal already. You don't need an SEC to make fraud illegal. It's just illegal. If you lie and deceive someone and steal their money in some investment scheme that wasn't real, the police should just go in and arrest you for fraud. Mm-hmm. There's no reason that the SEC should even exist whatsoever. Yet they do, and they make all these rules telling adults how they can interact with each other financially. It is the opposite of a free market. It's the opposite of what America is supposed to stand for. And it causes an immense amount of damage to the economy and to anyone actually trying to build something new.
Right, okay. So is KYC something that is likely to come to Shapeshift? Because there is also a benefit to Shapeshift in that if you also know your customers, you can talk to them. As I said to you before, like Coinbase talk to me all the time. I never forget them. They talk to me on social media. Or they talk to me in an email. They talk to me in their app. And I just think one of the things that as I mentioned to you before, that Shapeshift goes out of my radar sometimes.
Yeah.
So is there a benefit?
It's an interesting point. I mean, there is a benefit in having accounts that people can use because you can have a closer relationship with your customer. Absolutely. And so we've considered that. Whether those would become mandatory or not is an open question. I would never want that to happen. Mm-hmm. If the regulatory risk got so high that I felt like it was the only path that would protect the company and indeed the users of the company, then I might have to take that path. But it would suck. I mean, accounts should be optional. Yes, there are benefits to them, but they should be optional. Mm-hmm. So if it ever happened, I mean, it would be under duress. I mean, it would basically be us saying, we're being forced by these guys with guns to do something that our customers don't want, that we don't want, and that we think is unethical. But that's kind of par for the course. I mean, there's a lot of things that I have to do that I feel are unethical. I'm forced at gunpoint to pay taxes, for example, which I think are unethical. I don't want to be giving money to an organization that buys missiles and bombs brown people around the world. I don't want to be funding that, and yet I'm forced to do it. It is the reality that we live in the situation where most people want government to get involved in the lives of adults and tell them what to do and what not to do. Personally, I think it's unethical, and I'm unfortunately in the minority.
Okay, I'm going to deviate a bit here then. So this is making me think, obviously I had limited time to prepare today, but it's making me think about something I saw, the Free State Project. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming there's some alignment between what that is and what you're talking about here.
Yeah, so Free State Project is an initiative to get 20,000 libertarians to move to New Hampshire. It's kind of a long-going, like, multi-decade thing. I actually had signed up for that and moved to New Hampshire back in 2011. And it was actually there that I learned about Bitcoin from another Free Stater. But when I discovered Bitcoin, I pretty much left the Free State Project, even though I very much still support that mission, simply because Bitcoin, I felt, would deliver those objectives to a far greater scale and all over the world. So instead of spending the next 10 or 20 years fighting these fights just for one tiny little territory, I could spend the next 10 or 20 years fighting these fights and actually have a chance at liberating much of the world.
Right, okay. Wow, okay, but that's a pretty big ambition. So how do you see that just being delivered by what you're doing in terms of your business projects, or do you do things outside of that?
Well, everything I do is crypto-related. Because I see crypto, you know, Bitcoin in particular, and the usage of crypto as money instead of fiat is the best way to actually limit and reduce the scope of government. I think if people are using crypto as their means of value storage and payments and as their money and their currency, governments are not able to inflate currency anymore, which is a big part of how they fund themselves. They tax, which everyone understands, they borrow, which just means taxing later, and then they print money, they debase currency. That third piece goes away in a world where cryptocurrency is widespread. So even if the entire cryptocurrency movement simply achieves the objective of removing, you know, one significant piece of the funding mechanism of government, I will feel like that has been a huge success.
Okay, so then I understand what you're saying, and it sounds great, and I think it's... And did I read you've exited most of your dollar? You're trying to operate as much in crypto as possible?
Yeah, I mean, I have dollars. I'm not without dollars, but I prefer money that can't be created out of thin air. So,
and I think
I choose Bitcoin.
I think a lot of people would support you, and I would. But I think it's easier the more crypto you have. So it's going to be easier for you, you know... You were in crypto in the early days. You know, you created Satoshi Dice. You sold that, so you can ride the swings and the volatility. I think some would say, like myself, it would be a lot harder because the volatility changes my life.
I've never been one to advocate that people put all their value into crypto. I've advocated very much the opposite.
Right. Okay.
Crypto is extremely volatile, extremely risky, experimental. And you should just assume it's all going to go to zero. I've told people that since 2011, and it's been something I tell myself all the time. If you can accept that fact and accept that volatility, and you're still interested in participating and having some kind of stake in it, then go for it. But don't do it thinking it's a sure thing. You should think it's the opposite.
But I don't believe you think it will go to zero now. I think we've crossed.
At this point, any particular crypto could go to zero,
yeah,
right? You
course.
Could find some zero day in any chain that takes it to zero. But the concept of a truly digital decentralized currency, I don't think that can die. That can't go to zero. So even though any particular coin could, and if you have your funds in the coins that go to zero, you could lose it all. I think the idea will live forever. And I don't think that can die at this point. I think humanity has found a new tool that it can use to transact more freely with each other. And it, just in the same way that the internet allowed people to communicate more freely with each other, and humanity would never accept the internet going away, I don't think humanity will accept decentralized digital currencies going away.
No, and I agree. And it's funny, the longer I've spent working in crypto and the more I use it, the more I see the benefits. So the amount of times I do that is quite limited, but for example, when I pay my mining fees, I pay it to a guy in Washington from here, it just makes sense to pay by crypto. It's instant. You know, he calls me up, he sends the invoice, 5 minutes later or 10 minutes later, he's got the money.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes sense. But that makes sense for me because I work in a crypto world.
Mm-hmm.
I operate in a crypto world. I still struggle to help people, my, you know, standard normal friends with their normal jobs, to fully understand beyond a price speculative asset. How do we bridge that gap?
It's the question that everyone's been asking the whole time. Like, how do you get to mainstream adoption? And I don't know that there is an answer for that other than time and letting it grow organically. You know, there are 10 to 20 million crypto users in the world at this point. So that's not at all mainstream, but it's also not uncommon anymore. Like, on my way over here on the tube, I saw a crypto advertisement, and I heard a lady at the airport the other day just talking about Bitcoin. Like, it's starting to become part of normal society. It's still very niche, but it's getting there. And as people become familiar with it, they will be more open to radical ideas like taking some piece of their salary in crypto, or being paid by someone at the bar in crypto, whereas they only would have accepted cash a year before. That stuff happens gradually at the margins. But probably one day people kind of wake up and realize that it's just kind of normal and everyone's using it a little bit once in a while.
I kind of hope and kind of think, you know, when I was researching my interview with Trevor from Polymath, what it seemed to me like was that this is actually a very important use case. And I was thinking that as people start to buy things that exist on blockchains and and want to invest in blockchains, that we have crypto base layers like Ethereum and Bitcoin, and the fact they will need to own it to interact with those technologies and those assets, that will drive the adoption. But it's not the, I don't see it as crypto for, as much for going in to buy your coffee. I think it's more operating. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah, I think the physical coffee shop that everyone has this romantic notion of using to buy your coffee with Bitcoin at the coffee shop, I think that's kind of going to be the last phase. Mm. It's useful for a lot of things, but today it's not great for that.
Okay, so back to Shapeshift. Sorry, we deviated there.
No worries.
So what are the challenges are you facing now? What are the outside of
other than regulatory?
Yeah, what else are you facing?
Well, you know, I mean, just to be frank, having a company that grows to 100 people, it is just hard to have an organization of that size that grows to the 100 that quickly. A year ago, we were like 20. And a year before that, you know, we were 5.
So you middle management, HR.
Well, those things start happening. And like, how do you do that? And when you do that, you cause some other problems in order to solve these. And like, just I've come to appreciate the difficulty in just building an organization. And I didn't really know what that meant before, but I'm starting to. So that's been a challenge itself. And you know, we're getting there. Like I love my team. They're an incredible group of people, and it's been a learning experience for all of us, because a lot of us have never been in these kind of positions before, or building anything that was this big or important.
And I also noticed you bought KeepKey.
Mm-hmm.
That was quite an interesting acquisition.
Yeah, about a year ago we acquired KeepKey.
So there's quite a natural fit between hardware wallets and having a form of exchange.
Yep. I've long wanted to provide the world a way to hold and convert their crypto without having custodial risk. You know, I come from the Mt. Gox days, and I've seen many of these exchanges go under. Hundreds of millions of dollars have been lost, and it is just so antithetical to how crypto should work that everyone is just holding all their funds at this centralized place. And I don't fault those exchanges. They're important, and Shapeshift's model has its own drawbacks. But I think it's important that people have a way to hold and convert their assets without having to trust anyone, or at least that the trust is very minimal.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I mean, we're building a better interaction between KeepKey and Shapeshift so that you can hold your coins on the device and convert them easily, and you'd never have to worry about having funds at some other party.
So it almost feels like decentralized.
It's somewhat decentralized. Yeah. I mean, the key management, the holding of the assets is decentralized. It's on all the devices around the world. And Shapeshift is not decentralized, but Shapeshift's period in which you have to trust it is really tiny.
Right.
Just during the transaction. And so the net risk to the company of a hack or anything like that is just so small that it's negligible. Like, you know, we could get hacked and no customer money would be lost at all. And if it was, it would be so small that, you know, I could pay it out of my pocket. So keep getting that trust as minimal as possible, I think, is a good goal of any crypto company.
And just to move for a second, how scary is the proposition of being hacked? And how
we did get hacked in 2016.
Was it 2016?
April. Yeah.
Right. Okay. I didn't know that.
We wrote a whole piece about it. The whole story. It's called "The Looting of the Fox." If anyone wants to read it.
Right.
And I'll basically, it was an insider. We hired this guy to run our IT security. Ironically.
Yeah.
He was a total douchebag thief and ended up stealing several hundred thousand dollars of our assets. And it wasn't enough to kill the company, but it was enough to be real scary. And when that happened, as horrible as it was, and as vulnerable as it makes you feel when like someone that you trusted betrays you on that level, it also validated the model. It also proved the point that by building it in this way, we're protecting people, because not a single dollar of customer money was lost. And by not having accounts or registration, not a single piece of personal information was lost. So in an age of like the, you know, Target and Experian hacks, where people, hundreds of millions of records, personal information are getting stolen, none of that got stolen at Shapeshift because it wasn't there. And no money got stolen from customers at Shapeshift because it wasn't there.
Just Shapeshift's money.
It was our own money. It was our own inventory, because we hold an inventory to serve the customer orders. So he stole our money, and that was painful, but no customer money was lost.
And what happened to him?
Well, for all the claims that the government likes to make that they're here to protect us, we basically contacted the authorities, handed them all the evidence on a silver platter, proving that it was this guy. Like, we had logs and like a few smoking guns. And we knew where he lived. We told them, like, gave everything that they needed to go arrest the guy and be the hero. And they didn't do it.
So he just got away with it.
Yeah, we haven't heard from him since. He's gone.
Wow, yep. Shocking.
Yeah. Meanwhile, I pay a gazillion dollars in tax money to this organization, and the time I needed them to actually step up and do their most basic function, they totally failed me.
And a prison system that keeps a lot of non-violent people in prison.
You get caught with a little bit of white powder that you want to have a fun night with, and you go to jail and sit in jail, but you rob hundreds of thousands of dollars from a company, and we tell the police exactly who it is, and that they don't even care. You know, it wasn't like enough. I don't think it was a big enough robbery for them to care.
Right, okay, God. Okay, so back to KeepKey. What differs KeepKey from Ledger and Trezor?
Yeah, so Ledger and Trezor are the two other large wallet providers, and I have to say both of those projects are great also. So I think all three of the wallets are really good. KeepKey has some aesthetic reasons why I like it more. It has a bigger screen where you can see, you know, a full mm-hmm. address of where you're sending to. But it's not materially better than either of the other wallets at this point.
Right, okay. So they're all just pretty much the same.
They're all great. I mean, yeah. I own all three. I love all three. All three companies are good.
I don't have a KeepKey. I do have the other two. I tend to prefer Ledger because I like the little app.
Ledger has done the best job, and they have the most units sold for sure. I think they've sold like 1.2 million Ledgers worldwide, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, that's cool. But I was only recently aware of KeepKey, and I looked at it and thought, actually, it just looks kind of sexy.
It's really cool. Nice. It's a really nice device. That was one of the things that we liked about it. So we have some catching up to do with Ledger, I'll admit that. But I think the competition's good, and it's going to be a massive market for these.
But that's just mainly marketing, right?
No, I mean, I think their app is better. I mean, some people find it harder to use than KeepKey, but I think it looks nicer, and they also just released this new Vault product, which is really good. So they are definitely the leader of the pack at this point.
I do tend to find, though, that there isn't enough of a difference between Trezor and Ledger that if Trezor supported more to coins, I would probably just go with Trezor. Hmm. Is the addition of new coins that complicated? Is it big?
It can be. So the addition of new blockchains is generally complicated, right? Okay. So KeepKey actually just 2 days ago released ERC-20 support. So now you can have a whole bunch of different tokens on KeepKey. And it took a long time to get that infrastructure.
Visually see them separate and send them separate? Mm-hmm. Or you...
Yeah.
Because you can't do that with Ledger. I have to go to muted it, right?
Yeah, no, natively in the app. It's very cool. You can convert them in Shapeshift in the KeepKey app. So that's all cool, but that took a long time to do. And each new ERC-20 is easy now, but if we added another blockchain, you know, like if we added the new EOS blockchain, if it ever launches, that'll be a big project to get that to work.
Right, so look, conscious of time, the last thing I wanted to ask you about was Prism, just an update. So I was aware of Prism a while back. Mm-hmm. You can just tell people what Prism is and what the state is, because I know it's in beta, but, you know, when do you think it will be released?
So Prism, we released into closed beta. We announced it, you know, about a year ago at Consensus, and it's still in closed beta. So a lot of engineering behind the scenes has been happening, but the largest obstacle right now is, yet again, regulatory. So the way that it's built, it's essentially creating smart contract-based derivatives to create these portfolios. And the technology is really cool. I mean, it basically allows you to have a trustless portfolio in which neither party can screw the other one. It's arguably a swap in which there's no custodial risk, which is like a huge, I would say, financial achievement. And yet we're worried about regulations in the US from, you know, CFTC. So we're trying to navigate that and figure out exactly what we need to do. If it wasn't for that, it would have been out months ago.
Because I remember hearing about it a long time ago. I think I heard you talk to Laura about it. I've seen the visuals on the website. Yeah. And it does look pretty cool.
It's cool. It's cool technology. And I think it helps demonstrate that when you have programmable money, you can do all sorts of really interesting financial applications that Wall Street and the banks have not innovated in 100 years, and yet most of it gets caught up in this regulatory bullshit.
Yeah, and are there any other projects you guys are working on that you want to be aware of?
There is another one, but it's secret, so it'll come out a little later this year.
Can you tell us what area it's in?
Nope, it's a crypto project. I should tell you that much.
I still assume at some point you will look into some kind of custody solution as well. We'll keep key to
we won't ever hold people's custody.
Right.
So I'll say that much.
Okay. I think I know what that means. Okay, so just to like wrap up, just tell us what you're up to over the next kind of weeks, months, how people can get hold of you, how what you want to hear people from.
Yeah, I mean, on Twitter, at Eric Voorhees, E-R-I-K-V-O-O-R-H-E-E-S. That's probably the best place to get in touch. I'm also eric@shapeshift.io email. And I will unblock you.
Thank you.
I'm curious what tweet you said that made me block you.
I'll have to dig it out. Do you know what? I think
I don't block many people. I've probably blocked 10 people ever.
It was definitely during the SegWit 2X, and I was probably in my earlier Twitter days where I think maybe most people go through this where they get a little bit punchy and then you realize you should just kind of calm down a bit. So I'm a little bit calmer these days. But I think I said something about thinking the New York agreement closed doors was bullshit, blah, 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 and I was surprised.
Something that vanilla wouldn't have caused it. So I'm curious.
We should dig it out.
In any case, I really enjoyed the interview.
And I apologize.
I will unblock you. Great questions today, and thanks a lot for having me on the show.
Thank you for coming on.
Cheers.
So what do you think of that? Did you enjoy it? What do you think of Eric's? Pretty cool, right? Great to have him on the show. Great to talk about everything they're up to. If you don't know Shapeshift, I recommend checking them out. It is a different kind of exchange, but it's pretty cool. I use it when I tend to feel lazy and I can't be bothered to log into an exchange. So yeah, I recommend taking a look. I'm also going to check out Prism when it becomes available, and I'm definitely going to get myself a KeepKey. It's a very cool looking device, actually. But I've tried Ledger, I've tried Trezor. They're both pretty cool, but I think I'm going to try a KeepKey so I'm aware of all of them. I'll put links to all of that in the show notes. But yeah, I hope you enjoyed it. If you've got any questions, feel free to email me. I said my email at the start of the show, but it's hello@whatbitcoindid.com, and I do try and reply to everyone. And please support the show. Please do leave us a review on iTunes. Follow me on social media. Check out my website. Everywhere I'm at What Bitcoin Did, and I will always try and reply to you. Okay, listen, I hope you all have a cracking week, and I look forward to speaking to you next week. Okay, take care. Bye.